Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I'm a former middle school teacher, current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And so on this podcast, I interview experts who know a lot more than I do about this topic. I share structures and strategies and protocols. I tell stories about the things that worked for me, but also those big epic fails that I made along the way, because ultimately I believe that teachers play a profound role in helping students reach their creative potential. And I think that becomes really important in a world of machine learning and AI. And one of the things that makes it challenging to engage in that deeper, sustained, creative kind of work is distraction, which is why I'm doing a series. The last podcast episode I dealt with introducing this series of deeper learning, deeper work, whatever you want to call it, focused work. I'm calling it the concentration code. And so today we're going to talk all about this idea of how do we design systems to improve focus and attention. We're not going to talk about pedagogy. We'll get into that in a future podcast episode. We're going to talk about the physical environment and then also like the assignments and the structures and those types of things, and something called cognitive load, how we can reduce cognitive load. So without further ado, let's dive into today's episode. Picture this: a group of 20 first graders wanders around a wooded creek searching for examples of animals and their adaptations within the environment. They pull out magnifying glasses and identify the bugs, which they'll eventually call insects. A few kids scream in excitement, their voices echoing throughout the forest. Others slow down, soaking in the beauty of the surrounding and intently studying the habitat. Some seem energized, others relaxed, some social, others quietly introspective. But they all have one thing in common. They're focused, fully engaged, so absorbed in their learning that they might not even think about it as learning at all. In another city, in another school, a fourth grade class is silently reading. Here the desks are in rows, and the fluorescent light cannot compete with the canopy of trees of that previously mentioned outdoor classroom. There is a pin drop silence, aside from the narration escaping the noise-canceling headphones of a student who is visually impaired. On the surface, this space feels ordinary, mundane even. But when I walk in before a teacher observation, nobody looks up, not even the teacher candidate that I'm going to be observing. Beneath the surface, the mundane becomes magical. Each student here is lost in their own fictional world, interacting with imaginary characters and engrossed in all kinds of plot lines. Some are visiting a far-off planet or a fantastical world. Others are reading works that feel so real and identifiable that they can place themselves within the story in an instant. Every child is reading a different chapter book, many at different lexile levels. But they all have one thing in common. They are focused, fully engaged, so absorbed in their learning that they might not even think of it as learning. In another classroom in another city, a group of middle school students engage in an inquiry-based STEM project. The students shift from individual to partner to small group learning. The teacher pulls students aside for skill-based workshops and keeps everyone on this fairly tight time deadline. It feels relaxed, but also intense. There's this steady calm as students engage in inquiry and research and problem solving. But also the room is loud, like really, really loud. There are no desks, just tables in this makerspace with adjustable chairs and standing centers. And this space is the opposite of that fourth grade class that I just described. This space is loud and dynamic and full of energy, but again, relaxed. There are moments of frustration. One kid tries so hard to find a solution and buries his head in his hands when his prototype doesn't work. A boy next to him gives him this side hug and allows the kid to cry. Every student in this class has a learning difference. Every one of them is different from each other in where they are struggling. But yet again, they all have something in common. They are focused, fully engaged, so absorbed in their learning that they might not think of it as learning. Now, this is just a small snapshot of focused, fully engaged learning that I have had a chance to witness as I visited classrooms all around. Some of them local when I do observations of student teachers, some of them in some of the workshops that I've done and the chances I've had to just visit the classes and the schools where I've led PD. And I've seen small town rural schools and inner city schools and schools in suburban enclaves. I've seen public Title I schools and elite private preparatory schools. And along the way, I've seen that there is no one single way to do deeper learning. Sometimes it's quiet, other times loud. Sometimes it includes frequent transitions, and other times it is a long block of extended time. It can be largely solitary or deeply collaborative. It might be a mock trial or Socratic seminar in the humanities block, but it could also be a challenging math problem or a lab in STEM. It might be an active PE class or a solitary silent reading activity in that fourth grade classroom. It might earn the label of traditional or authentic. It might be called progressive. It might be called classic. It doesn't matter. What I see in all of these cases is that these moments are powerful. In a culture of distraction, these are the moments when students are fully engaged and focused on their learning. And this requires us to move past something called continuous partial attention. These are the moments when students might experience either an individual or collective state of flow. And when this occurs, students are more likely to retain the knowledge, and it leads to higher achievement. In other words, the learning becomes sticky. This longer sustained cycle allows the students to retain the information, and then they learn it later. So again, they learn more in the moment, but they also retain that knowledge longer. I'm not going to get into all the research, but there's fascinating research that I mention in the blog post that corresponds to this. Here, students, though, are learning at a deeper level. So they're learning more, but they're also learning it at a deeper level. So let's imagine the first thing is they're learning more in the moment, they're retaining more of it later, but they're also learning it at a higher cognitive level. They're learning it, the content at a deeper level. And I contrast this to something called continuous partial attention. If you're not familiar with it, this is an idea that was developed by Linda Stone. And she talked about the fact that we are often in this state where we are not fully paying attention to what's in front of us. We're on our devices. If we're not on our devices, we're thinking about our devices. And what happens is continuous partial attention is the enemy of this focused learning. It's the opposite. And in our culture, it's become very common to engage in this continuous partial attention. So the net result of it is that students are raised in this environment of instant amusement and rapid-fire content. And as educators, we unfortunately, are tasked with this challenge of helping students develop the sustained focus learning that goes against the continuous partial attention. We want their full attention. Now, in a future podcast, we're going to talk about classroom environment. We're going to get into pedagogy. We're going to talk about how to make these things a daily habit, how to build endurance. We're not going to get there yet. We're going to focus first on the systems of the classroom. And the first space I want to think about is the physical environment. So as we think about the physical environment, I want you to imagine me as a middle school teacher. I'm in probably my sixth year of teaching at the time. And I stood in my classroom and I just stared at the walls. In previous years, I had hung up student artwork. And I'd kept it pretty sparse, but also inviting. I'd placed a few symbols as a reminder of what we were learning. And I'd used these plastic frames to frame student work that we rotated on this schedule. It had been highly visual, and there might have even been maybe an artistic vibe, but it was also minimalist. But this year, this was different. I had hung up the required grammar posters and word lists. I had printed up every district mandated word for the grammar wall and word wall. I had hung up the two anchor charts that we were required to do and the student data charts. And so it went one by one, the walls and the cabinets being covered with required artifacts. At one point, I stood in the middle of the room and I tried to pay attention, but I was so distracted by the words and the colors and the bright neon colors. They were just competing for my attention. It had felt like an encyclopedia or maybe a dictionary had just vomited onto my classroom walls. The first week went by and I began to wonder if maybe my students were experiencing the same thing. Did the space feel cluttered to them? Was it distracting to them like it was for me? Now, I knew that we were doing this for a reason. There was a solid set of research suggesting that word walls in particular could function as a visual scaffold that would help students reference vocabulary and grammar, and they could then work in a more integrated process. So I knew that it mattered, that was important. But years later, new research has actually emerged about classroom clutter, and much of it has confirmed the concerns that I had at the time. And I'm not going to get into the research too much again, but studies have indicated that workspace tidiness is linked to task accuracy and efficiency in high school students. They found that for elementary students, visual overload is a very big concern, and that highly decorated classrooms increase off-task behavior and reduce learning outcomes. They notice that there's actually lower engagement and, surprise, lower focus on the task at hand. Now, does that mean that we just have to ditch that thoughtful themed classroom space? Do we have to pursue that drab, beige, early elementary space where everything is done in this like muted tone? No, I don't think so. I'm actually really skeptical about that. I think the lesson here is that we need to focus on intentionality instead. You might limit wall content to essential instructional items that align closely with the lessons that you're teaching, but also maybe keep that really cool vintage Hello Kitty poster. You might rotate anchor charts or word walls to feature only the most relevant concepts and vocabulary. You might opt for neutral soft colors for background boards, but then choose some bold colors that stand out when you want to highlight key information. It also helps to adopt natural elements like plants in moderation that has this calming effect as well. So we can be very intentional about how the physical space leads to focused learning. It should be noted, of course, that a cluttered classroom is nothing compared to the havoc of a smartphone in terms of distractions. We're going to get there. Trust me. We're going to have a whole podcast episode devoted to devices. But the physical space sets the tone. So that's the physical space. Great. The next space that I want us to think about is something called cognitive load. And this deals with the way we give directions, but also sort of the structures of our courses that we teach. And so let's talk about cognitive load first. I want you to imagine holding a 10-pound dumbbell over your head. For many people, that's pretty easy. It's what you do when you do a shoulder press or an overhead tricep extension. Now, hold that weight for 2 minutes. It's still possible, but it's getting a little more challenging. Your arm might start shaking, your muscles burn. Now hold it for 15 minutes or an hour or 2 hours. Over time, even a small amount of weight grows absolutely unbearable. Your muscles can only handle the weight for so long before needing a break for recovery. In a similar way, our brains can only handle a certain amount of information before we hit what John Sweller calls cognitive overload. Now, he coined the term cognitive load theory, CLT, and he talks about it in terms of how the brain stores new information with a focus on the limitations of working memory. Sweller proposed these three different zones of load. Intrinsic load, that's the inherent difficulty of the material. It's going to take a lot of cognitive load to do vector calculus, for example. And this is going to depend on how much knowledge you bring into the equation yourself as a learner, but also just how challenging the material is inherently. That's the intrinsic load. Then we have the extraneous load. This is any of the distractions, unnecessary information, anything that doesn't aid the learning. Irrelevant details, cluttered visuals, that's extraneous cognitive load. I will say sometimes people get excessive in limiting this extraneous load. I've heard people say, for example, that we shouldn't use humor in the classroom, and they forget that, yeah, you pay a small price on cognitive load, you gain something in classroom culture. So it doesn't have to be perfect. But that's number two. So intrinsic, that's how hard the learning task is. Extraneous, that's the distractions that pull you away. That's the extraneous parts. And then there's the germane load. This is the mental effort used to truly understand the process, material, all of that. And this is what's needed to really master the content. It's how much work you put into it. So the goal then is that we want to design learning in a way that increases the encoding and retrieval of the material. What does it mean? How do we address it? How do we make this work? Well, the first thing that we can do is when we give directions, when we design the structures of the instruction. So again, not pedagogy, just the overall systems and structures. We can use something called chunking. This is where you break things into chunks to make it more manageable. So you can change the way you give directions. So what you do is step one, practice step two, practice step three, practice instead of giving long multi-step directions. And on this topic of directions, we can also provide video directions that have visuals and auditory directions, but no written words. So I know it's a little bit odd, but you actually make them audio directions and you give it verbally and you show what it looks like. So what you're doing here is you're reducing something called the split attention effect that happens when you're alternating between paying attention to words versus reading them. There's a whole thing in cognitive load theory about that. But the bottom line is create some video directions. Now, there's a time and a place to also write out some of the directions to kind of keep it simple. That can work really well as a strategy too. We just have to be very intentional about how we do this. And we can also do things like breaking a lecture into smaller chunks. with both individual and process and partner processing time. So small group, partner, individual. And here you can make use of a lot of the great cooperative learning strategies like a think, pair, share, you know, rally, robin, any of those types of things. Also provide a blueprint showing where you are going with your learning. So give them a schema that they can see, a blueprint. This is where we're going. This is where we've been. This is where we're at. Introduce new concepts gradually with plenty of processing time and break down bigger projects into chunks with deadlines, phases, protocols. I have a whole podcast episode if you're interested about how we reduce cognitive load in PBL. John Sweller, the founder of this theory, hates PBL. I'm not entirely sure why. I kind of know where he's coming from. But I actually think we can do PBL in a great way that reduces the cognitive load. But what we can also do is be more intentional about our physical course design. For example, we can use consistent language and more intuitive design. And this consistent language helps students focus on the content without being distracted by what a new term means. So that consistency reduces the cognitive load. Using templates that students are familiar with, protocols that they're familiar with, all of those things help reduce the cognitive load. Another thing that we can do is use better visual aids. Visuals like charts, diagrams, and images can help convey information quickly without overloading the verbal working memory. Working memory is multimodal. There's no such thing as like a visual learner and an auditory learner or whatever. So using visuals that reduce cognitive load is amazing. They should be clear, directly relevant to the topic, and we need to be very intentional about using things like labels on the visuals, not using a key that they have to look at and go back and forth, because that creates extraneous load. I just got to say, for me, you know, as a slightly disorganized educator, I'm still working on how to improve how I deliver content, how I, you know, put courses together, how I make things more intuitive, how I use headings or bullet points or white space, all of those things. But I've gotten a lot better. And a great starting place there is actually something called UX design theory. I'm a huge fan of it as a way to help reduce cognitive load because it's focused on this very empathy-driven approach to you know, how we design our systems in our class. Ultimately, today was just all about the structures and systems. It's a great first place. We can't control things, right? The frequent interruptions that we have, short 45-minute class periods, the pings of devices that are trying to get their attention with, you know, new notifications. But what we can do is create a physical environment that is conducive to focused, deeper work. And I think that's the goal. We can reduce cognitive load in some of our assignment designs and our instructions and all of those types of things that we do. But again, this is just a start. To crack this concentration code, we need to focus on our pedagogical approach as well. And so in future podcast episodes, we're going to talk about that idea of how we can improve motivation, pedagogy, how we help students develop the habit of focused learning. We'll dive into all of those podcast episodes in future episodes. So I'm really looking forward. Please stick around with me on this journey. I'm super stoked. I'm going to use that word stoked anymore, but I'm super excited about this. Hey, would you do me a favor? If you enjoy this podcast, would you tell a friend about it, a colleague, a trusted colleague? You know what? Even share it with a colleague that maybe you don't trust completely, but might still enjoy this podcast. Would you also leave a review on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify or wherever it is that you get your podcasts? Again, thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day and go out. Make something awesome. Hey, thank you so much for listening to this podcast. Would you do me a favor? If you enjoy it, will you tell a friend about it? And would you also consider subscribing to this podcast and going to Spotify or Apple Podcasts or wherever it is that you get your podcasts and leave a review? Just click the little stars, however much you think this podcast is worth. That would be fantastic. And again, like I mentioned before, please check out my blog, sign up for my newsletter. It is at spencereducation.com. Again, thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day and go out and make something awesome.